Atra, in this connection. Api, indeed. Udaharanti, they cite. Imam, this. Itihasam, history. Puratanam, very old. Yamasya, of Yamaraj, the superintendent of death, who gives judgment after death. Apretubandhunam, of the friends of a dead man. Samvadam, discussion. Tam, that. Nibodhata, try to understand. Some translation. In this regard, an example is given from an old history. This involves a discourse between Yamaraj and the friends of a dead person. Please hear it attentively. So you can repeat, in this regard, an example is given from an old history. This involves a discourse between Yamaraj and the friends of a dead person. Please hear it attentively. So purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai. The words itihasam, purathanam, mean an old history. The Puranas are not chronologically recorded, but the incidents mentioned in the Puranas are actual histories of bygone ages. Srimad Bhagavatam is the Maha Purana, the essence of all the Puranas. The Mayavadi scholars do not accept the Puranas, but Srila Madhvacharya and all other authorities accept them as the authoritative histories of the world. Atrapyudharantimam itihasam puratanam yamasya pretapandhunam samvaram tam nibodhata. So, Om Ganatim Dandasha Gananjana Shilakya Chakshurum Meditam Yenatasmai Shigurve Namaha. So, there's several points to be made in regard to this verse in purport. The first is in regard to the histories given in the Puranas, as Srila Prabhupada comments in the purport. They're not chronologically recorded. So, in Western history, what we're accustomed to learning about Western history, chronology is extremely important. I know that many of you, at least those of you who were born in America, learned all these different dates when you were young. Probably in Finland too, right? You had to learn different dates. In America, we have these dates like 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And then you have all these other dates, which I've actually forgotten because they didn't give me a poem to remember them with. Like Magellan and Vasco da Gama, Ponce de Leon, as we mentioned the other day, discovering the Fountain of Youth, Pony Beach. So you had all these different dates that you have to remember. It used to drive me crazy because they would give me a list of dates that I'd have to remember for my exam, and I would study the dates, and during the exam I would regurgitate the dates. That means to just like write them down. And then after the exam, I forgot all the dates. Because I was thinking when I went to the university or went to the high school, I was thinking, what is the use of remembering all these dates? I mean, what is it going to do for me? And so generally, people have to have some utility for remembering things, not just to impress people by speaking a whole bunch of dates that make people think you're intelligent. So the Vedic literature is not like that. You know, you don't find like some specific dates. And even when it's given, it's not really that important. And things are mixed together. You have, let's say, one appearance of the Lord amalgamated with another appearance of the Lord. Like you have that story of Varahadev picking up the earth planet and then fighting the Hiranyaksha afterwards. And the Acharyas he mentioned that these two stories are from different kalpas, and they're amalgamated. So, you know, why do they do that? Because the whole purpose of the Vedic literature is to teach Siddhanta. Siddhanta means the conclusion, perfect conclusion. And in the Western world, we have no perfect conclusion, like if you ask your history teacher. So what's the perfect conclusion about studying the Revolutionary War? She won't even know how to, she or he, won't even know how to respond. What's the perfect conclusion? Perfect conclusion? What do you mean by that? I mean, what did we learn from that? Well, don't fight wars, huh? But that's not a perfect conclusion, because sometimes wars are necessary for defense, like the Mahabharata War, for example. And World War II, you know, the Americans had to go in and save all the Jewish people who were in the concentration camps and save Europe, basically. We saved Europe. The good old Americans. Save Europe. So sometimes war is necessary. So what do you learn from the Revolutionary War? Not to have revolutions, to be revolutionary, that the British are no good. You know, what are you going to learn? What lessons? What's the Siddhanta? I don't know what the Siddhanta. Of course, there is one Siddhanta, Vedic Siddhanta, from the Revolutionary War. The material world is miserable. I mean, that you can learn, you know. Adiatmik, Adibodhik, Adidaivik miseries. I mean, if you read about the Revolutionary War, or any war in history, you'll read about how the soldiers and the people suffer the threefold miseries, isn't it? So that's a perfect conclusion. But that sort of perfect conclusion you won't find elaborated on in your high schools or universities. Imagine if you raise your hand in class and say, yes, I've learned from the study of the Civil War or the Revolutionary War that this material world is full of miseries. And one who takes birth is sure to die. And one who dies is sure to be born again. You will fail that course. Even if you're giving the Siddhanta, the perfect conclusion, which is interesting. So basically, Vedic literatures have a purpose to them. I mean, one who just looks at one part of the Vedic literatures or takes the Vedic literatures out of context, they don't understand the purpose of the Vedas. That's something like we have this expression in English, not seeing the forest for the trees. In other words, you're so close up to the forest, you're just seeing one tree, you're seeing a pine tree, for example. And you think, you know, the forest is a bunch of pine trees. But then, when you go higher, like you take your helicopter, or I take my quadcopter up, then you can actually see the whole forest and understand the totality of the forest and actually how all the different entities interact in the symbiotic or parasitic or whatever relationships that they have. Actually, it's mostly symbiotic. The different living entities, trees and the bugs, and they all have some relationship. I mean, it's like even in our body, there's all these little creepy crawlers, small creatures that are crawling on our skin and at all the times, basically. Of course, unless you're in a sauna bath like a Finland. But they're crawling on the skin, and what they're doing is they're eating the dead skin. You know, they're doing something good for you. So it's a symbiotic relationship. So if you just look at the bug, you think, ew, we've got to get rid of it. But actually, there's a purpose for the bug. So anyway, so the Vedas have a purpose. And that purpose is described by Krishna, as everybody knows, in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And what is that? Vedas-chaya-sabaya-raham-eva-veda. By all the Vedas, Krishna is to be known. So, in other words, they're all pointing ultimately towards Krishna. Even when you deal with the Karmakanja sections of the Vedas. Karmakanja sections means that people perform some activities to get pious results, so they can go to Swarga, they can go to heaven. Mm. Or even if you deal with the Gyanakanda section. Gyanakanda means the section of knowledge or renunciation from this material world. If you look at it as a totality, it has a purpose. I mean, for example, the Karmakanja section, where people are encouraged to perform pious activities in order to get some material result, has a purpose of bringing one closer to Krishna, because in the Karmakanda section, you ultimately chant Vishnu's names, or you chant Om. You know, just by chanting Om, even though you don't know what you're doing, that's a Gyatra Sukriti, you're getting closer. Or you're understanding there's a higher power. I mean, at least that's a first step towards ultimate self-realization, is when you understand there's higher powers in the universe. Prabhupada said even the aborigines or the uncivilized people, they worship the sun or the moon, and they accept some higher entity. That's a first step, and we should appreciate that. Of course, the scientists have taken a step backwards, you know, a thousand steps backwards, where they don't think that there's some higher living entity. They think generally everything is happening due to chance. Even the laws of nature happen according to chance. You know, they talk about the law of gravity, like that, action and reaction, or different law of entropy. And all these laws, they just happen by chance. That's pretty crazy, isn't it? It's just like we're driving down the road, and the police stop us because we're going too fast. And we say, you know, how did this law happen? This is by the policeman pulled us over and said, just by chance. We came up with this 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. No, some group of people met and they decided and they wrote it down and the police were enforcing it. There's a whole mechanism there. It's not that things are happening by chance. Even within the cell of the body, everything's nicely organized. So the scientists, that's why we say they're atheistic. Much more atheistic than the aborigines. At least the aborigines accept there's something greater. You know, they're worshiping something greater. So the Vedas, in the beginning, they bring you to the point of understanding there's some higher purpose, higher knowledge, higher goal, higher entity, something higher that you accept. And they trick you into chanting Vishnu's names, ultimately. And if you just, if a scholar, as Prabhupada mentions here, just reads the Rig Veda, it'll be very hard to understand the goal. And actually, the Mahabharata talks about this. So, Tarko Pradishta Shutina Vibina. This, of course, is a statement from the Mahabharata that Tarko Pradishta, you cannot establish the ultimate goal or Siddhanta with argumentation, mundane logic. Tarko Pratishta does not establish apatishta, actually. Shutina Vibina. Nor by reading the Vedic literatures, because the Vedic literatures, Vibina, are multifarious. So someone could just get lost in the forest of the Vedas. And of course, Krishna advises Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita that Trigunya Vishaya Veda, Nish Trigunya Bhavarjuna, Nirjana Bho, Vitrasatvashto, Nir Yoga Chemat. He says, rise above the three modes which are generally being taught in the Vedas and understand the purpose of the Vedas and be established in the self. This is actually Krishna's statement to Arjuna. So, the Vedas do have a purpose, and they're just like different steps, like the yoga ladder. Yoga has a purpose. You know, there's different steps in the yoga ladder, and of course, the highest step is yoginam api sarvesham madgatenam taratmana shadavam vajita yomam same yugatamomata. The highest step is actually being Krishna conscious, the topmost yoga. So the topmost understanding of the Vedas is to understand Krishna. That's obvious. So that's the first point here. The second point Prabhupada makes in his purport is how the Mayavadis, he says, Mayavadi scholars do not accept the Puranas, which is quite interesting. So what do they accept? They accept the four Vedas and the Upanishads. Actually, the word Upanishad means to come closer in regard to the spiritual master. I mean, to approach closer, Upanishad, sit down and approach closer. So they accept these four Vedas, and of course that's the Rig Veda, Samaveda, Yajur Veda, and Atharva Veda. And the four Vedas, I can explain what they deal with. The Rig Veda is the Veda hymns. Generally they're to the demigods, but there's always an Om there first. And Samaveda is like music. You know, that's the musical accompaniment to the hymns. Yajurveda is the swaha business, you know, the sacrifices like that. Ashwamedha, Golmedha, and all that other stuff. And Atharva Veda is an interesting Veda because it deals sometimes with curses, with different mantras to, let's say, if you want to have a Pushpaka Vimana, you know, you want flower airplane, if you want to do all these different things. That's the Atharva Veda. It's sort of an interesting Veda in that particular regard. So it's quite interesting that the Mayavadis don't accept anything more than the four Vedas and the Upanishads. Of course, there's 108 principal Upanishads. We're most familiar with the Ishopanishad, which is a very important Upanishad, describes the nature of God. Om Purnamidam, Purnamidam, that the Supreme Lord is perfectly complete, even though so many perfectly complete units emanate from him, he remains perfectly complete, and also Ishopanishadam Sarvam. Anyway, we go through the whole Ishopanishad. We used to chant the Ishopanishad for Mangalarti in the beginning days of the movement. This is before we had the Guru Vashtaka prayers. Can you imagine? Every morning was Isha Vashamidam Sarvam Yakin Cha Jagajam Jagat Hina Jaktena Bunjata Margaret Haka Shasidnanam. That was our Mangalarti. Do you remember that program? Or no? No.
I didn't come that
early. Oh, you didn't come that early. Because we didn't know the Guru Vashtaka prayers. And eventually, you know, Prabhupada taught us the Guru Vashtaka prayers. So, that's why Prabhupada, one of the first books Prabhupada published was the Ishopanishad, because that established Vedically the position of Krishna. And how, and also later on in the Ishopanishad, it describes Aranyamena Patrena, that the devotee is praying for the Lord to remove his effulgence so he can see, so the devotee can see Krishna's real form. So the Ishopanishad is definitely a personalist presentation of the Absolute Truth. In other words, take away your Brahman. I want to see you, Krishna. I really want to see you, Lord. It takes so long, I know. Take away your Brahman. Anyway, so as George Harrison chanted. So that's the Ishopanishad. And so the Upanishads are actually very personal in their presentation. And even in the Rig Veda, there's an interesting verse that the Mayavadis and also the Arya Samajis, they're the modern branch, the formalized branch of the Mayavadis nowadays. They're called the Arya Samaj and the Brahmo Samaj. And so what they do is they accept the four Vedas. But if you talk to them about deity worship or anything like that, oh, wait. Like Dayananda Saraswati. Anyway, there's a whole history there. So they just don't accept anything else other than the four original Vedas. And some of them mostly accept the Upanishads. So it's very interesting. The Arya Samaj was formed as an attempt, and the Brahma Samaj was formed as an attempt to bring peace between the different religions in India. Because the main sticking point between the Muslim religion and the Hindu religion was the deity worship. That was the main problem. You know, the Muslims, they can accept us chanting Hare Krishna. That's not a big problem for them. They can accept us wearing dhotis. Of course, they also wear dhotis. And they can accept us shaving our heads, although they don't shave their heads. But they can't accept deities or statues, you know, demigods or anything like that. That's just like, you know, wow, they just go crazy. They're not even allowed to make a picture of Muhammad. Recently, there was several different occasions in the United States where people, in order to challenge the Muslims, they came up with this a festival, Draw Muhammad contest. Has anyone heard about that before? They actually, and it aroused the ire of so many Mohammedans. Or, actually, they don't like to call Mohammedans members of the Islamic tradition. So, they actually don't like to be called Mohammedans. Because they don't want to be called after Muhammad. Muhammad is a prophet, and the reason they don't depict him is because Muhammad didn't want to be seen as God. That's one of the reasons. And they think they would go against Muhammad's philosophy. In any case, so the main sticking point between the Hindus and the Muslims was the deity worship of the Muslims that destroyed so many deities. Muhammad himself destroyed like 360 different statues when he went into the Kaaba. So the Brahma Samaj and the Arya Samaj was an attempt to bring everyone together. And so they said, we just accept the four Vedas. But what they didn't realize is they didn't read the Vedas very carefully. The four Vedas and the Rig Veda, it states, Om Tad Vishnu Param 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 Pashanti Yat Surya. That's right from the Rig Veda. That means, Om Tad Vishnu Param Param, that the demigods are looking to the supreme abode of Vishnu, Param Padam. Om Tad Vishnu Param Padam. Pashanti Yat Surya. Surya means the demigods, Pashanti means to see. So the demigods are actually looking to the abode of Vishnu. That's a very important verse in the Rig Veda. And also, there's verses in the Upanishads, which they very conveniently avoided. Like in the Chandogya Upanishad, this interesting verse, Itihasa Purananam Panchama Veda Uchite. And that's one of the key verses. Probably quote that verse from time to time. In that verse it states, Itihasa. So here here we're talking about the Mayavadis don't accept the Puranas or the Itihasa. Itihasa means history. Basically the word Itihasa means thus it happened in Sanskrit. And Purana means something old. That's Purana, or original. Old or original. Just like in, if you go to Radhakund, there's a temple called the Purana, Radhakrishna Purana deities. That means the original deities that were discovered by Raghunath Das Goswami when he was excavating Radhakund. There's deities there. Radhakrishna Purana Mandir. Anyone's been there? No. But anyway, one of the first temples you visit. It's right near the marketplace of Radhakund. So, Puran means original or old. Itihasa means history. So there's the difference. Even though the Puranas have histories, they're different from the Itihasas. Because the Puranas are defined in a certain way. They have to have the cosmic creation, subsequent creation, and then ultimately devastation, and ultimately revelation of the Absolute. There's different topics that have to be there to be considered a Purana. That differentiates them from the histories. Histories means primarily the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. Those are the two main itihasas. You follow itihasas, histories. The Puranas are something different. Puranas, basically, they hint at a higher truth. There's, 18 Puranas, 6 are for those people in the mode of goodness, 6 are for those in the mode of passion, and 6 are for those in the mode of ignorance. It's not that the Purana is in the mode of ignorance, it's for people in the mode of ignorance. There's something for everybody to help everybody become elevated to Krishna consciousness, just like the original Vedas, which recommend worship of the demigods or recommend material acquisitions. That's to help people gradually become elevated. So anyway, in the Chandogya Upanishad, it does mention that the Itihasas and Puranas, they're part of the Vedas. They're Panchamo Veda Uchite. They are known as the fifth Veda. Uchite means to be known as Panchama, like Panch, means five, like Panchatattva. Panchama Veda Uchite means they are known as the fifth Veda. So we accept that. And the histories told in these different literatures are bona fide histories. They actually did happen. It's not simply some metaphorical stories. I mean, there are metaphorical stories too, like the story of Puranjana is a metaphorical story. But that's obvious. That point is made in the Srimad Bhagavatam itself, where Narada Muni is discussing this with King Prachinibharisat. He says, once there was a king, O king, just like you. His name was Puranjana. Puranjana means basically every man. And he was going to his... it's obviously a metaphor because he's talking about the different gates of the body being different gates of the city. If I was to say, that once there was a person, sometimes he went to his eye, he was living in a city, and part of the city was called his eyes, another part of the city was called his rectum. You'd understand it's a metaphor. I mean, because there's no city in the world that has a gate that's called eyes and a gate that's called rectum. Other than the body. Yeah, but Detroit. They don't call it a rectum. It is. Iti hasapura. Anyway, so it's obvious that's a metaphor. But the other cases, these are actual things that happened. Not in chronological order, but things that happened. Like Krishna's pastimes. Because if you take things as being simply metaphorical, then you'll start to doubt even Krishna's pastimes. Krishna's pastimes actually happen. And they happen differently in different universes. That's why you find descriptions in supplementary literatures like the writings of the Goswamis that appear to be a little bit different than what's described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. I mean, for example, in the story, the Lalita Madhava by Srila Rupa Goswami, you find Radharani, when Krishna leaves Vrindavan, Srimati Radharani jumps into the Yamuna and leaves this world. You don't say leaves the body because she's transcendental body. She goes to the sun planet. So that's different than the description given in the Bhagavatam. Given in the Bhagavatam, and even in Chaitanya Charitamrita, you find that Radharani and the gopis, they meet Krishna in Kurukshetra later on, right? So one may say, why is this different? It's different because there's different manifestations of Krishna's pastimes in different universes, in different yugas. I mean, Krishna appears once in a day of Lord Brahma. It's not that he has to do everything exactly in the same way every single time. You know, it's not that someone comes up to him, there's a producer who comes up to Krishna and says, now you have to dance like that on the Kaliya, now you have to do it like this. And Krishna says, yes, sir. And then there's some film producer, take two, Krishna, dancing on the Kaliya snake. Take three, you did it wrong that time. Take four. No, but Krishna does things differently. There's infinite variety in Krishna's pastimes. That's why you find some descriptions are different from different in different literatures. So, but they're accurate. They're accurate descriptions. Okay, let's go back to the Vedas a little bit and discuss the different Vedas. So we have the four Vedas. Let's finish with timing. So we have the four Vedas, then we have the Upanishads. And then after the Upanishads, you have the Vedanta Sutra. Vedanta Sutra is written by Srila Vyasadeva. And of course, the Vedas are also eternal. I mean, I should mention that too. And certain parts are mentioned, are elaborated on in one universe and may not be elaborated on in another universe, just like Bhagavatam is only 12 cantos here, and other universes maybe 1,000 cantos or 1,000,000 cantos, depending upon the ability of the people in that particular location. So, anyway, so you have the Upanishads. The Vedanta Sutra is a commentary on the Upanishads. The Vedanta Sutra is written in codes. That doesn't mean Morse code. It means very short, pithy statements that refer to certain Upanishads and give the essence of the Upanishads. I mean, Tato Brahma Vyasa, for example, that's the beginning. Dhamma Jasya Yatha, that's another verse in the beginning of the Vedanta Sutra. It says, now is the time to look for, to search for the Absolute. Tato Brahma Vyasa, to look for Brahman. The knowledge, Vyasa means to get knowledge of Brahman, basically. And then, and what is that Absolute Truth? That Absolute Truth, Janma Jasya Yataha, and of course the Bhagavatam starts with the same thing. The Absolute Truth is that from which everything comes. And so these are comments, without going through the whole Vedanta Sutra, these are comments on the Upanishads, different Upanishads. And then different Acharyas, to establish their particular disciplic succession, write commentaries on the Vedanta Sutra, like Shankaracharya's Sarirakya Bhasha. which is a Mahavadi commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, taking the indirect meaning. And then, of course, you have Ramanujacharya, Sri Bhasha. Bhasha means a commentary writing. So all the great acharyas wrote commentaries. And the bona fide commentaries coming from disciplic succession are also considered part of the Vedic literatures. Just like we have Prabhupada's commentary on the Bhagavatam, it is an essential part of the Bhagavatam. People say, well, just read the Bhagavatam and not Prabhupada's purports. The purports are part of the Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam is an expanding, dynamic literature. As we find in the Bhagavatam itself, there's four verses that were spoken in the beginning of the Bhagavatam, the nutshell verses, Hami Basam Evadri. And those are the four verses that were spoken by Vishnu to Lord Brahma. And the Bhagavatam expands from there. So it expands as it goes through. That's why you find all these descriptions, Shukadeva Goswami, Swami. Then you have all the different sages asking questions of Suta Goswami. Suta Goswami's father was killed by Lord Balaram. Interesting story. So this is all an expanding, let's say, exposition on the Absolute Truth. So Prabhupada's commentaries are actually an essential part of the Srimad Bhagavatam. They can't be separated from the Srimad Bhagavatam because they're commentaries by a pure devotee, a Shaktivesha avatars come from the spiritual world. So anyway, we're talking about the Vedanta, and then after the Vedanta, there's the Itihasas, the history, the Ramayana, the Mahabharata. And even if you read the Ramayana and Mahabharata, it's very difficult to understand the Absolute Truth. You still get confused. Even Srila Vyasadeva was chastised by Narada Muni for confusing people by writing the Mahabharata. He was chastised. You say, what? Because you read the Mahabharata, it's very difficult to understand it, because it's the Supreme Personality of God. Of course, you read the Bhagavad Gita, that's easy to understand. But most people, they skip over that philosophical section. And they just like the stuff about the war and the astras. And they say, wow, that's cool. The astras means weapons. And so Vyasadeva, and you find so much, let's say encouragement indirectly for sense gratification. You know, you have kings with many wives, and Arjuna, you know, going on pilgrimage and discovering the Lupi, having a relationship with her, kidnapping Subhadra, and you think, this is pretty cool. So you take these things out of context in the Mahabharata, and so Vyasadeva was chastised by Narada, his spiritual master, for encouraging people to engage in sense gratification in the name of self-realization, in the name of the Vedic literatures. He was actually chastised, and therefore, at that point, he began to write the Srimad Bhagavatam down. So you have the Itihasas, which are very confusing to people. I mean, like so many people, they read these histories, they talk about Ram, they think Hanuman is God. I mean, you find that all these concoctions there. Like there's Panchamukha Hanuman, they worship Hanuman with five heads. Complete Mayavadi stuff. And they've read the Ramayana. And then there's even some versions of the Ramayana that are even tinged with Mayavadi conceptions, like the Tulsidas Ramayana. Prabhupada said that. So people get very confused about who. And you go to a place like Fiji where they recite the Ramayana regularly, and then after their recitation of the Ramayana, they all get drunk or drink kava together and just like hang out all night long being intoxicated. You know, so there's no understanding. How can you read the Ramayana and take intoxication after reading the Ramayana? It just bewilders me. Or they don't eat meat just during the 9 days Ram Navami, coming before Lord Ram's appearance, and then right after Lord Ram's appearance, they pig out. I mean, it's just crazy, because they don't understand the Ramayana, they don't understand the Mahabharata. People love the Mahabharata, just like in India, the Mahabharata, when they put it on television, everybody is watching it. But how many people became Krishna conscious? How many people surrendered to Krishna? How many people became vegetarians even after watching the Mahabharata? It was just like, you know, a nice series. And then so therefore, the Puranas, especially the Bhagavad Purana, is necessary. And so then you have the Puranas, which are the ultimate conclusion the Siddhanta of the Vedic literatures. And so we accept all the Vedic literatures, and ultimately, under the guidance of Srimad Bhagavatam, and Srimad Bhagavatam is actually the cream of the Vedic literatures, the nectar, the essence of the Vedic literatures. So we see through the lens of Srimad Bhagavatam all the other Vedic literatures. So we have about 15 seconds left for class. Any questions or comments? Perfect?
Yeah. There's a nice offering that...
Quick.
Brother gave in the novel, and he was speaking about the prophet introduced the books in the beginning. He said if these books are for hearing, Vishnu John would sit down with all his brahmacharis and speak the books.
Yeah, this book, whoops, books are meant for us, not just distributing. They're meant for hearing. The hearing. That's nice. Yeah, it's nice to read the association of devotees. It becomes more potent. We can get a spray bottle to keep you awake.